I don't think that's true. I think they're equally important, but very different.
Well, the others will be used in what you were saying, they aren't in it.
That's right. But the creature criticized sounds of homogeneous parents are used right now. Now these other folks are going to be useful someday, but not now. Right, I think they're equally important, but you think it's different. But what's going on in Vice Garrison? I mean, whatever it's interesting. But they're plotting stuff out from the other side,
but they are never
going to be afraid. Not missing this, but what life is, you know, and all. Well, you know, it's not to think of an interesting thought. It's a little bit up to bed. You like to see anything. We've got room for chips to actually build a few thousand theaters. Because every local universe has a meaning of age. The ambassadors of country. And there are exactly 700,000 meanings of age. That's a fixed number for most people. But there are already more than 700,000 theaters. In one place it says, more than 700,000. In another place it says, well nigh a million. And they keep on being created. That means some creator things are never going to have a chance to function in the presence of the universe. They're going to have to wait for all these things. And their whole experience will be close to the same as creators. And that's where I get the notion there are going to be two kinds of creators on the other side. Those who have functional creators and those who have if they divide up outer space among the creator signs who have worked in the fabric of the universe, then each creator sign is going to be responsible for something on the order of the larger than a major sector of the community. And to me it's quite likely that the younger senior son will function under their jurisdiction. But that's all sexual. And then what's going to happen in the second part of the system? Which is much different. Ever since. Leone is not only not going to stop, it's going to get tremendously larger. Enormously larger.
There will be you. There will be you.
Whatever.
Oh.
They can, but they aren't going to open that up until the whole thing gets opened up. You'll have to wait. Sure. You'll have to wait their turn. Let's close on one note here. We're talking about the quiet time between the universe ages. The perfected grand universe of those future days will be vastly different from what it is at present. That's the seventh of the universe, but not outer space. Gone will be the thrilling adventures of the organization of the galaxies of space. The planting of life on the uncertain worlds of time, and the evolving of harmony out of chaos, beauty out of potential, truth out of meaning, and goodness out of value. The time universes will have achieved the fulfillment of final destiny. And perhaps for space, there will be rest, relaxation from the age-long struggle for evolution and perfection. But not for long.
Oh, I'm so relaxed.
Certainly, surely, and inexorably, the enigma of the emerging deity of God the Ultimate will challenge these perfected citizens of the several universes, just as their struggling evolutionary forebears were once challenged with the quest for God the Supreme. The curtain of cosmic destiny will draw back to reveal the transcendent grandeur of the alluring Absonite quest for the attainment of the Universal Father on those new and higher levels revealed in the ultimate of creatures.
In other words, we will find
God's
Supreme,
that
there
is a search
for
God's Supreme. Yes, and that's page 1293. I think I can find it. On page 1294, Leona, 1293 is when I read this last paragraph of the speech. On 1294, they give you their philosophy of growth and then rest. Then growth and then rest. Don't keep you running all the time. When you graduate as a senior, then let's just stick around a while and enjoy being a graduate. You don't go to school, you teach it. Don't make you become a freshman at a higher level immediately. On page 1294, creative growth is unending, but ever satisfying. Endless in extent, but always punctuated by those personality-satisfying moments of transient goal attainment, which serve so effectively as the mobilization prelude to new adventures in cosmic growth, universe exploration, and deity. Quiet period. While the domain of mathematics is beset with qualitative limitations, it does provide the finite mind with a conceptual basis of contemplating infinity. There is no quantitative limitation to numbers, even in the comprehension of the finite mind. No matter how large the number can be, you can always envision one more being added. And also, you can comprehend that that is short of infinity, for no matter how many times you repeat this addition to numbers, still always, one more can be added. At the same time, the infinite series can be totaled at any given point, and this total, more properly a subtotal, provides the fullness of the sweetness of goal attainment for a given person, at a given time and status. But sooner or later, this same person begins to hunger and yearn for new and greater goals, and such adventures and growth will be forever forthcoming in the fullness of time and the cycle of eternity. Each successive universe age is the antechamber of the following era of cosmic growth, and each universe epoch provides immediate destiny for all preceding stages. Havona, in and of itself, is a perfect, but perfection-limited creation. Havona perfection, expanding out into the evolutionary superuniverses, finds not only cosmic destiny, but also liberation from the limitations of pre-evolutionary existence. You know, that's so comforting, because while the final goal is non-attainable, all other goals are attainable. And you have the wonderful feeling of goal attainment. And by golly, you can sit on that goal for a little while and say, but I made it. Whether it's citizenship on Jerusalem, or Edentia, or the attainment of paradise, they never push you on. They wait until you get the cheese. When you get good and tired of being a graduate and want to be a freshman, this is the indication it's time to move on to the new book. But they wait for your hunger to grow. When you cross home plate, you don't make you go bad, by the way. Everybody applauds, but you know what? It's short of run, see? And you don't have to go to bat until you're ready. I like that. And when you're ready, there's a new game.
There's a new game starting.
That's
it's
going to
be in the middle of everything you don't know.
Well, that's a great statement there.
Oh, well, I love that. I tell you what I like. If you ask why we have
It has helped with a man's present orientation to attain all possible comprehension of deity's relation to the predicate. While absolute deity is eternal in nature, the gods are related to time as an experience in eternity. In the evolutionary universes, eternity is temporal, everlasting, the everlasting now. I think of time as a railroad rail that goes from horizon to horizon for the past and the future. And I think of eternity as a great wheel that's rolling down this rail. And where the wheel touches the rail, that is a moving moment of the everlasting present. That's where time and eternity impinge. And I feel in my bones that there will always be time. There always has been, there is now, there always will. You want to know not to show what I found them. I found them and I got them noted in my book.
Oh.
Let me see. Got to be in part two of the thing. Well, I was getting close. I'm on 554. I'm working backwards.
Problem with boys.
Much tougher than the Ten Commandments. Much. 551, paragraph 3. One of the purposes of the Marantra career is to effect the permanent eradication from the mortal survivors of such animal vestigial traits as procrastination, provocation, insincerity, problem avoidance, unfairness, and ease. That's murder. These are the cardinal sins of mankind. You tell them right, we all do. The only reason I don't speak to you is I have time. But I sure would if I had time. Thank you. ones are the cardinal sins of mankind. And it's also the reason procrastination, you put it off. Equivocation, you straddle. You don't commit yourself. You're broken steel, rudder. You're giving double talk.
You broke a steel rudder.
Yeah. Insincerity. Well, that's real bad. Problem avoidance. Said Scarlett O'Hara, I'll think about that tomorrow. Unfairness. You just plain subhuman. Ease seeking. You're a definite animal. Animal vestigial trait. I used that in a talk in a graduate commencement talk I gave to you at the Great Lake. And I said that I thought they were a training advantage. And the whole stuff of this. And the whole whiplash of reality on the economic level could help us be less mammalian and more human to do. Get rid of these things. It makes them fresh. I just came off of the animals with good sensitivity. I thought I talked about you first.
Well, don't leave her unpregnant.
Okay.
She has no other.
And I can see some real parallels between the Roman Empire and the United States of America.
Fast being little.
Mm-hmm.
Fast being little.
I see a loss of craftsmanship, a loss of pride, and performance. Stuff of
mm-hmm.
Right? We've got a crazy little organization. We work hard. And you know what makes us the top of the table? Even if we were kind of dumb, we have business and we work hard. I even got the girls working right for the same world. We just pay us the damn much money to make us more fun about living again. So we got some good tips.
We have nothing.
We get turnovers and we get them young and they stay there. And at the moment we have no presence in the land. The land looks pretty soon. We can get a couple of men. You got a point, Rick. It's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to these young people. They wanted to not only to do some work.
But they're looking at that here. Right?
Yeah.
They don't want me to go.
I'll tell you a frightening statement. Mm-hmm. This is frightening. And it will mean more if I actually quote it. Apostles learned from Jesus about the kingdom of heaven, and Jesus learned much from them about the kingdom of men, human nature as it lives on Urantia and on the other evolutionary worlds of time and space. These 12 men represented many different types of human temperament, and they had not been made alike by schooling. Charlie, the implications of that statement are frightening. Now I had 9 years in school, and then I got out of school for 5 years. And I went back. And I've always thought that 5-year hiatus in there was real valuable because I didn't believe what they taught me when I went back. They could change. I mean, I would filter things. I would listen to it. The only guy could say, but you could be wrong, you know. That's very true. Very true. Very true. They had not been made alike by students. Gee, that. They don't say it anymore. But the implication is just horrific.
If we follow Rome, that means we don't blow ourselves off. Then we get softer and softer. We breathe down.
In other words, good germplasm maintains a high standard of living and curtails breathing. And we keep lowering our basic aptitude level in the country. In time, we're soft picking for the rest. At the moment, it's the Chinese.
Yeah.
And then we'll become an enslaved people. And you have a planetary imperium, which lasts until infancy. In other words, you have a worldwide empire. So we have world government, only people by force. And we go down simply because we give up. Or we're in attitude. The Romans went down because they never could provide a stable government. The last Roman that came back to Rome was Julian, the last non-Christian emperor. And he was named Caesar, which is the number two language in Rome. And this guy suddenly became a scholar, became a terrific general, and then he escaped out of the detail. He just cleaned up the Rhine province, so the whole Germans were on all sides, but they were in the Roman army. So what happens when these soldiers proclaiming Augustus, which is the top dog, and now he's going to fight a civil war with his first cousin. And that's the last time the Romans ever cleaned up the Rhine, and there was a fight there. In the meantime, everything has gotten rigid. You're a baker. You're born into the baker's room. Your old man was a baker. And you can be condemned to death if you don't take bread. You're an alderman of a city. You want to be an alderman, but you're stuck with it. Your old man was an alderman. Because it's breaking you to fast you. And you know where you can get out of being an alderman is to beat it. You can put the flesh of your wealth behind you. Take off and join a monastery or something. You're a sea captain. You have to haul trees for the Roman government, 8 months out of the year, then you can offer yourself for something. You see, you've got a completely different society. Currency is so debased that civil servants are paid in chips, which enable them to go to warehouses and draw what they need, avoiding money. Silver coins are made out of copper with a thin silver wash on it to give them that silver. Inflation is on the final round. Yeah. And then pretty soon, the Romans die out first. The provincials come in Spain, from Illyria, from Gaul, and they're good men. They maintain the empire. As they begin to play out, then the Teutons come in. And their allegiance is not completely Roman. There's bad blood between the Roman and Teutons. And pretty soon, the crowds were across the Rhine and attacked to the fire and the empire goes down. But it rotted the internal system. At no time were the Romans ever unable to whip the Germans on anything like an even basis until they ran out of arms. The Romans just had scientific warfare to do, which never did mention from the Pax system. But pretty soon no more Roman arms from the system. Will win. that's the end of it. In civilization, the weaker, being the more numerous, when they vote, they make it easier and easier and easier for themselves. And it's the stronger who takes.
And they cool it more like it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. This is not question. I just don't get excited about it. I'm concerned about just a couple of things I can make a living. For the family. And the rest of the time I work for the group of economics, policy, the atom bomb. I don't know what to worry about, but this is a contract job. I've only an academic condition. I'm a public interest in the financial aid.
My question
is,
here,
I'm
sure. I wasn't taking your name for your political ideology.
It's not pleasant to
come here, but... I'm taking your name for... subjective into your past, but I mean...
I will say this.
For me?
I think that the greatest thing that's happened to America is Russia. We need a challenge, Abby. Because we're getting about like mashed potatoes. Now Russia's got a scare. And maybe the meeting the Russian calendar will avoid some of these pitfalls. I regard Russia as almost indispensable to American development. Now, God knows the Russians don't plan it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's their unwitting result.
You see the first modification in the maintenance on the Korea, where it was still led by me after World War II, wasn't it?
Suddenly, it was the biggest thing you could have for them. It shook it. It shook it. And all of a sudden, it said, gee, competition. They didn't feel fucking something. They could get real, you know, we're real smug about the atom bomb, and quite that. But they didn't quite something. We still have a self destruction, definitely. When Khrushchev says, we'll bury you. He will. But we don't need competition. One of these days, and this I think is going to have a salutary effect on our whole economy, one of these days we're going to have to compete with Russian steel in the international market. And at this point, the American Union is going to have to learn a lesson or two.
Maybe so.
Maybe so. Correct.
Maybe so.
Right. Someday we're going to have to elect people who have ideas.
An idea.
An idea. Well, we haven't done too well, I think.
Well, yeah.
The president, the president incumbent is the one just about the way I figured he would. He graduated in the middle of his class. He trained as a staff man. He's not a flashy commander. He's no Patton. He's no MacArthur. He's no Eichelberg. He's not even a Montgomery. Here, just to take one idea now. Consider this. You know all the stink that's made about the Suez Canal. Now we don't need the Panama Canal. It's not vital to our defense anymore. We don't have one ocean navy and two oceans. We've got a big airport. Why in the devil don't we offer the Panama Canal to the United Nations? And let the UN take over the Panama Canal bonds. You know, let them have the revenue and let them pay off the bonds. We could still use this canal, we could use it now. And what a beautiful gesture this is. Because we're not giving away anything that's essential. So, the Panama Canal is no longer a strategic necessity. But why the devil don't we get smart and take the initiative? Instead of waiting until the Panamanians join Castro or something like that. We sit here and we look at dictators in Latin America and we give them medals because it's all peaceful. Then we wait and we have a revolution and what have we got? The alternative is not too good. I'd like to see, why don't we get an ideology that's based on God? Instead of talking about the American way of life, which adds up to a very crass deal. This means more marshmallow topping on a Sunday. It means pickle elite plus mustard on their hot dogs and more film on their automobile. In other words, a real comfortable life, you know, suburb, security, whatnot. Why don't we talk about God? This is a safe subject. This creates no controversy with Catholic, Protestant, or Jew, or Mohammedan, or Hindu, or Buddhist. Why don't we fight this on an ideological basis? Those who believe in God versus those who do not believe in God. We need spark plugs in our old world. We haven't got them.
You see, Clyde,
our problem is that we lack virtue. We're selfish, slothful, peaceful, and the rest of it.
Naturally,
we are good to other nations because we're afraid that Russia will be better to them than we are. We're in exactly the position of a devout Christian in the Middle Ages we're going to go to the line, not because we love God, but we're scared as hell of the devil and hell. We have yet to learn to respond to his good spirit.
Instead of reacting to that.
Correct. And we don't know the mistake.
Yes, but it's a wonderful run.
This is outside of my line, Clark.
Damn kidding.
I don't fuck around with this sort of thing.
I'd like to divide the forces. On the little old plan?
Yes, we got it. Not that I won't pass
the pass. I'll give you a check. You're right, check. Bill, you evaded my question.
What's that?
Do you foresee?
Forces
on this boat, secondary, eventually arriving at that division. Let's just say to heck with magic, and we have to quit it. That's worse than magic. Well, that is magic. Everybody line up on this side of the room. That's the reason you got.
situation I had a number of years ago. I once had a son who was a walking question mark. And I was sitting talking with him one day, and he said, "Hey, Pop," he said, "this Berlin Airlift, what is that all about?" Like, for instance. He said, this Korean police action, what's that all about? I'll explain that to him. He said, "Every January you get real sight and you consider your income tax. Now, why are you paying so much in tax?" I explained, "In armaments and debts and so forth." "Well," he said, "didn't we win the last war?" Well, I patiently explained that to him, too. And he looked at me and he grinned and he said, "As near as I can see, old boy, your generation has loused things up about beyond recovery." And I got to thinking about it. We had loused things up pretty badly. We are a generation that's come along after about 300 years of lopsided growth. You know, the medieval Christian, the Black Death at Florence, he bowed his head and he said, as he buried his family, "The Lord give us, the Lord take us away, blessed be the name of the Lord." In the Renaissance and the rediscovery of the Greek viewpoint of life, and men began to say, "We don't have to die from the Black Death. There is something we can do about things in general, and material life in particular." And this was the beginning of the development of a scientific attitude in place of a simple, rather naive, religious acceptance of the vicissitudes of life. The watch cry of the Renaissance was, "Man is the measure of all things." And so we witnessed the birth of a new civilization, a resurrection of Hellenic culture, if you please, because the Greeks were the first real secularists, the first people who looked at life and said, "We can do something about this." Let's count our blessings. Representative government, universal education, an industrial system that gives us the highest standard of living that human beings have ever known, all the material comforts that we have any right to ask for, continued prosperity. But there's something wrong, friends. Along with that, we have succeeded in killing more people scientifically in my lifetime than have been killed in warfare in the last 2,000 years. We have loused things up. Our growth has been lopsided. We didn't just stop with the development of a scientific attitude. We didn't confine our scientific revolt to a revolt against superstition. We revolted against religion itself, to the point where I know human beings that are afraid of the word religion. They would shrink like wilted lettuce before they'd stand up and say to a group of people, "I am a religious man." Now, first, we're going to have to redefine religion before we get through the thing. Our growth has been lopsided. We have become so enamored of religion, of science, that we are worse than atheists. There's one thing worse than an atheist. That is a secular. An atheist is at least fighting God. He's paying God some attention. He's in opposition. A secularist is too busy to bother about God. He says, "Well, don't tell me I'm not, don't let my fellow men. I'm going to put more chrome on the car we're bringing out next year. We're going to cut the price of the dishwasher. We're going to bring out a new plastic. We're improving the standard of living. I'm going to give the union what they want in the plant. I'm a good guy." But his entire mind, his entire life, His entire thinking is occupied with material, temporal problems. He's full of ideas. He doesn't have too much in the way of ideals. Let me give you a horrible story. You know the story of the American prisoners of war in Korea? You know how they died like flies? These are our GIs, so-called Christians. You know the story of the Turkish prisoners of war in Korea? How a bunch of Mohammedans came through? Let me tell you what they did. When the Chinese removed their officers, the non-coms took command. When they removed the non-coms, the senior private took command. When a Turk got sick, three Turks were detailed to nurse him 24 hours around the clock. Those Turkish soldiers came through almost to a man without a casualty, which proved that working Mohammedanism is better than sleeping Christianity. Our Christian GIs died. The Mohammedans survived. Even a second-rate religion that's active is better than a passive first-rate religion. Willie Gritzel said, I wasn't going to talk. I said, 3 hours and we'll have an altar call. I don't mind if any of you look at your watches, but even if you're tempted, please don't take them off and shake them to see if they're still running. That one's cool. We've made scientific progress, but we are confronted with religious and philosophic stagnation. I don't believe that you can call 20th century people to the service of God with the battle cries of the Middle Ages. You know, I was talking to one little gal in Chicago about this book, and she pulled this bromide on me. You know what? The religion that's good enough for my parents is good enough for me. And I said, wouldn't that have been a fine position for the 12 apostles to have taken? When Jesus asked them to listen to some new truth, they could have just said, look, we're real conservative. We're for the law and the prophets and the Pentateuch and the books of Moses and so forth. And dear carpenter, who are you recruiting elsewhere? We not only have religious stagnation, we have philosophic confusion. Consider the confused ideology of the United States of America as we confront Russia. We're talking about the American way of life, and how do we define it? You have not only piccalilli, but mustard on your hot dog. You have bigger fins on your Cadillac, more chrome on your automobile, a super beauty rest to sleep on. Is this exciting? No. The communistic lies sound better than that. They claim to be fighting for mankind. We have philosophic confusion. We look at this world. We do not see the perfection which we think we might see if there were a God. We see imperfection. We see lots of problems. And we're inclined to discount religion because the world is not a nice, easy, sweet, perfect place to live in. I'd like to read you something. It's courage. Strength of character desirable. Then must man be reared in an environment which necessitates grappling with hardship and reacting to disappointment. Is altruism, service of one's fellows, desirable? Then must life experience provide for encountering situations of social inequality. Is hope, the grandeur of trust, desirable? Then human existence must constantly be confronted with insecurity and with recurrent uncertainty. Is faith, the supreme assertion of human thought, desirable? Then must the mind of man find itself in that troublesome predicament where it ever knows less than it can believe. Is the love of truth and the willingness to go wherever it leads desirable? Then must man grow up in a world where error is present and falsehood always possible. Is idealism, the approaching concept of the divine, desirable? Then must man struggle in an environment of relative goodness and beauty, surrounding stimulating of the irrepressible reach for better things. Is loyalty, devotion to highest duty, desirable? Then must man carry on amid the possibilities of betrayal and desertion. The valor of devotion to duty consists in the implied danger of default. Is unselfishness, the spirit of self-forgetfulness, desirable? Then must mortal man live face to face with the insistent clamoring of an inescapable self for recognition and honor. Man could not dynamically choose the divine life if there were no self-life to forsake. Man could never lay saving hold on righteousness if there were no potential evil to exalt and differentiate the good by contrast. Is pleasure, the satisfaction of happiness, desirable? Then must man live in a world where the alternative of pain and the likelihood of suffering are ever-present experiential possibilities. That is very straight philosophic reason, I submit. I'd like to offer you this evening what is to me one of the most priceless concepts in this book, as it deals with the province of science, philosophy, and religion. This I have used many, many times in talking to confused people without necessarily telling them about this book. Consider the largest word you know. I would suggest to you that the word is reality. I can't think of a bigger word than reality. That which is real. Let's subdivide reality. Let reality be like a teddy, a banner going right across the front page of a newspaper. I want to have three columns under it. And I want to have subheadings under each of these columns. And the three subheadings are things, meaning, and value. Reality comes in three different packages. There are things, there are meanings, there are values. Where religion makes its mistake is that it seeks to make pronouncements concerning things. Religion is not concerned with things. It's not concerned with the origin of species or with the origin of this world. One is a proper subject for genetics and anthropology. The other is a proper study of astrophysics, astronomy, and geology. Scientists are equally fat-headed when they are so unscientific as to make pompous, unprovable statements concerning religion. As scientists, they are concerned solely with things. We approach each of these realities with a different technique. If you're dealing with things, use reason, mathematics, a scientific approach. But if you're in the domain of value, there is no mathematics of value. Tell me, concerning altruistic love, what is its mass, its velocity, its amplitude, its hue, its wavelength, its dimension? The whole concept of mathematics becomes ridiculous when we apply it to the domain of that. In the domain of values, you can use faith. I would submit to you that things and values touch at no point, but both touch the area of meaning. And in the area of meaning, we use neither reason nor faith, but we try to use logic. And here is where we attempt the construction of an original, interesting, and engaging philosophy, which reaches out on the one hand to the thing concept, and on the other hand to the value ideal, and attempts to present us with a unified picture of the cosmos. To science, the absolute is a first cause. In religion, a loving father. In philosophy, a universal unity. The great confusion, I think, in the thinking of modern man is the confusion of things, meaning, and value. I remember many years ago, I had a couple of pretty sick children. And I got a good pediatrician on the job. And afterwards, I was out looking at the stars and snowing. And I had an urge to pray. And I said, all right, Willie, you're a typical human being. You're in a jam. What are you going to do, try to practice magic? You know, when you ask God to do things for your sake, this is the attempt to practice magic. Magic is the effort to bend the universe to your will and plans and purpose. And much of praying is nothing more than a modern practice of magic. Not too successful. I said, no, if you ask God to cure those kids, knowing what you know and feeling as you do, that would be blasphemy. I don't say that about any other human being, but to me, for me to pray that way would be blasphemy. So I said, I still want to pray. What am I going to pray for? I have no right to pray in the domain of things. This is not a fit province for prayer. Then it hit me. These children could not be permanently harmed. They might die, that's true. But this is not final. And then I found out what I could properly pray for, and it was a prayer of thanksgiving that this universe was so constructed that if I couldn't keep these children on earth, they'd be decently cared for and could embark on a very interesting adventure in eternity. People are worried about religion, confused about it, because it attempts to act irreligiously. It invades the domain of science and philosophy
it makes pronouncements concerning unity, concerning facts. It has no business operating in these areas. I remember when my children were growing up, they came bounding in one day and they said, "Daddy, what do we pray for?" Well, I said, "You know you have two fathers, don't you?" "No, no." "Well, I said, you got me and you get your father in heaven." "No," I said, "take a good look at me. I'm corporeal, material. Your father in heaven isn't those things." Then we define in terms of all the sensory mechanisms, see, touch, taste, smell, and so forth. I said, "If you want something material, don't ask your father in heaven for it." And I said, "I think he could get it for you. But as I observe the way the universe is set up, he's delegated this. And if he hadn't delegated it, I wouldn't have a job. So if you want a pony, don't pray. Discuss it with me. You're much more apt to get a pony." But I said, "If you want something that is not material," again, through the sensory mechanism, then I said, "Don't ask me." Well, they said, "What would that be?" I said, "Courage. I don't know how to make you any braver than you are. Happiness. I don't know how to make you any happier than you are. Kindness. I can keep you warm and I can feed you. I don't know how to make you more kind than you are." These things you should talk to your other father about. I make my living looking at people, evaluating them, studying them, and I'd like to make a flat statement. There are just two traits which human beings have that animals do not have, even in vestigial form. One is a sense of humor, and the other is a sense of religion. And I would submit to you that a human being who is deficient in humor and has no religion is somewhat infra-human. He is verging towards the purely mammalian or subhuman level of existence. I'm not only not afraid to say I have a religion, I'm prepared to say that a person who lacks one is in danger of classifying itself as a mammal. When you put all this together, now when I give this altar call, Griffin, you lead the procession. You always have to have a Judas joke, you know. I can't think of a better way of describing how this works in life than to read you their description of the life of the sanest human being, I think, that ever lived. And he had a good sense of humor, too. Even though the Commonwealth of Israel, 1st century A.D., gave him very little chance to express it. Although the average human being cannot hope to attain the high perfection of character which Jesus of Nazareth acquired while sojourning in the flesh, it is altogether possible for any human being to develop a strong and unified personality along the perfected lines of Jesus' personality. The unique feature of the Master's personality was not so much its perfection as its symmetry, its exquisite and sound unification. The most effective presentation of Jesus consists in following the example of the one who said, as he gestured toward the Master standing before his accuser, "Behold the man." The unfailing kindness of Jesus touched the hearts of men, but his stalwart strength of character amazed his followers. He was truly sincere. There was nothing of the hypocrite in him. He was free from affectation. He was always so refreshingly genuine. He never stooped to pretend, and he never resorted to shamming. He lived the truth, even as he talked. He was the truth. He was constrained to proclaim saving truth to his generation, even though such sincerity sometimes caused pain. He was unquestioningly loyal to all truth. But the Master was so reasonable, so approachable. He was so practical in all his ministry. While all his plans were characterized by such sanctified common sense, he was so free from all freakish, erratic, and eccentric tendencies. He was never capricious, whimsical, or hysterical. In all his teaching, and in everything he did, there was always an exquisite discrimination associated with an extraordinary sense of propriety. The Son of Man was always a well-poised personality. Even his enemies maintained a wholesome respect for him. They even feared his presence. Jesus was unafraid. He was surcharged with divine enthusiasm, but he never became fanatical. He was emotionally active, but never flighty. He was imaginative, but always practical. He frankly faced the realities of life, but he was never dull or prosaic. He was courageous, but never reckless. Prudent, but never cowardly. He was sympathetic, but not sentimental. Unique, but not eccentric. He was pious, but not sanctimonious. And he was so well poised because he was so perfectly unified. Jesus' originality was unstifled. He was not bound by tradition or handicapped by enslavement to narrow conventionality. He spoke with undoubted confidence and taught with absolute authority. But his superb originality did not cause him to overlook the gems of truth in the teachings of his predecessors and contemporaries. And the most original of his teachings was the emphasis of love and mercy in the place of fear and sacrifice. Jesus was very broad in his outlook. He exhorted his followers to preach the gospel to all people. He was free from all narrow-mindedness. His sympathetic heart embraced all mankind, even a universe. Always his invitation was, "Whosoever will, let him come." Of Jesus, it was truly said, he trusted God. As a man among men, he most sublimely trusted the Father in heaven. He trusted his Father as a little child trusts his earthly parents. His faith was perfect, but never presumptuous. No matter how cruel nature might appear to be, or how indifferent to man's welfare on earth, Jesus never faltered in his faith. He was immune to disappointment and impervious to persecution. He was untouched by apparent failure. He loved men as brothers, at the same time recognizing how they differed in innate endowments and acquired qualities. He went about doing good. Jesus was an unusually cheerful person, but he was not a blind and unreasoning optimist. His constant word of exhortation was, "Be of good cheer." He could maintain this confident attitude because of his unswerving trust in God and his unshakable confidence in man. He was always touchingly considerate of all men, because he loved them and believed in them. Still, he was always true to his conviction and magnificently firm in his devotion to the doing of his Father's will. The Master was always generous. He never grew weary of saying, "He is more blessed to give than to receive." Said he, "Freely you have received, freely give." And yet with all of his unbounded generosity, he was never wasteful or extravagant. He taught that you must believe to receive salvation. For everyone who seeks shall receive. He was candid, but always kind. Said he, "If it were not so, I would have told you." He was frank, but always friendly. He was outspoken in his love for the sinner and in his hatred for sin. But throughout all this amazing frankness, he was unerringly fair. Jesus was consistently cheerful. Notwithstanding, he sometimes drank deep of the cup of human sorrow. He fearlessly faced the realities of existence, yet was he filled with enthusiasm for the gospel of the kingdom. But he controlled his enthusiasm. It never controlled him. He was unreservedly dedicated to the Father's business. This divine enthusiasm led his unspiritual brethren to think he was beside himself. But the onlooking universe appraised him as the model of sanity and the pattern of supreme mortal devotion to the high standards of spiritual living. And his controlled enthusiasm was contagious. His associates were constrained to share his divine optimism. This man of Galilee was not a man of sorrow. He was a soul of gladness. Always was he saying, "Rejoice and be exceedingly blessed." But when duty required, he was willing to walk courageously through the valley of the shadow of death. He was gladsome, but at the same time humble. His courage was equaled only by his patience. When pressed to act prematurely, he would only reply, "My hour has not yet come." He was never in a hurry. His composure was sublime, but he was often indignant at evil, intolerant of sin. He was often mightily moved to resist that which was inimical to the welfare of his children on earth. But his indignation against sin never led to anger at the sinner. His courage was magnificent. But he was never foolhardy. His watchword was "fear not." His bravery was lofty and his courage often heroic. But his courage was linked with discretion and controlled by reason. It was courage born of faith, not the recklessness of blind presumption. He was truly brave, but never audacious. The Master was a pattern of reverence. The prayer of even his youth began, "Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name." He was even respectful of the faulty worship of his fellows. But this did not deter him from making attacks on religious traditions or assaulting errors of human belief. He was reverential of true holiness, and yet he could justly appeal to his fellow saying, "Who among you convicts me of sin?" Jesus was great because he was good, and yet he fraternized with the little children. He was gentle and unassuming in his personal life, and yet he was the perfected man of a universe. His associates called him Master, unbidden. Jesus was the perfectly unified human personality. And today, as in Galilee, he continues to unify mortal experience and to coordinate human endeavors. He unifies life, ennobles character, and simplifies experience. He enters the human mind to elevate, transform, and transfigure it. It is literally true. If any man has Christ Jesus within him, he is a new creature. Old things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new. I really won't use the 3-hour sermon tonight. I think it would be fun if we could talk a little bit. I wanted to talk to you just enough, read you just enough to get you stirred up. Are there any questions you'd like to ask? Oh, Bert said, would I define religion? I'll try this. I once collected around 30 different definitions of religion, all by different authorities, and no two agreed. I would define religion. Better still, let me describe my religion. Should I do that? I can do that more simply. Somewhere at the center of all things is the boss. And down here on earth are the boss's children, and they should be treated accordingly. That's my religion. If you want me to discuss my theology with you, it'll take more than 3 hours. But my religion is a very simple one. Somewhere at the center of all things is the boss. Down here are the boss's children. They should be treated accordingly. The formal definition of religion is this: some kind of a belief in some kind of a supreme being, some kind of hope of immortality, and some kind of ethic deriving from the relationship of God to other men. Most religions will qualify on that basis. Now, the minute you leave God and man's relation to God, no two religions are in agreement. Tell me some questions.
Someone has something on their mind. Boundaries.
Somebody may need to. Lord, if you disagree with some of us, let's have at it.
That is where they get it going.
Yeah. Somebody wants to stand up and just says, I think you're crazy as a loon. Well, we'll discuss relative sanity then. I'm confident on that subject, too.
All right, they want to challenge you on any of your definitions.
Sure. You want me to read just some more from there? I'm reading from the Rancher book. I'll tell you. This last section I read is on page 1101. It's the entire end of the paper. It's section 7, entitled The Acme of Religious Living. The first thing I read you is page 51, starting with paragraph 5. These statements are introduced with a statement, all evolutionary creature life is beset by certain inevitabilities. Consider the following. We call these 9 points the inevitabilities: courage, faith, hope, altruism, and so forth. This book tells us that Urantia is the name of this world. It's their name for this world. Universe supervisor's name. This book claims to be written by people that do not have skin on it. Do I make myself clear? No, it claims authorship of superhuman. I might as well say that right out in front of everybody. That's sort of like admitting you're illegitimate. When you call yourself a bastard, well, I mean, what can they say after that? I mean, you said it. We might as well get this one out on the table. Now, they name themselves in here. Yes. But they're not any names that I ever ran into before, except in the scriptures. Correct. That's correct. This book is written in, it's written in four parts. Say that again. In part. Yeah. They write about God, the universe. Well, they don't base it particularly on the Bible. They base it on their own personal experience. In part, yes, and part of it's a long ways away, too. This book starts out at the center of all things and deals with the subject of God. It proceeds outward, dealing with his associates. It covers the central universe and comes on out into the evolutionary creation. He finally gets down to talk about this planet. He gives the history of this planet, and the latter third of the book is devoted to the life and teachings of Jesus. And the book apologizes for dealing with things and says it will shortly be out of date when further scientific discoveries are made. It doesn't claim infallibility in that area. That's one way of looking at it, yes. Yes, they're quite apologetic when they're dealing with physical things. As they say, the best we can do is to give you a unified picture as of about where you are now. And this will shortly stand in the revision, because we cannot anticipate the discoveries of the next 500 years. This would be unearned information. When I use the word people, I am not referring to human beings. I'm referring to superhuman beings. Question. You know, years ago I used to wonder how... Years ago I used to think about what would happen when this was published, and I said to myself, Willie, are you going to have guts enough to stand up in front of people and tell them that this is a revelation that wasn't written by people? And here I am saying it. Does somebody have a point over here? I'd like to ask you a question. Don't you think the English is rather lovely? The whole book is written in a style that I find very engaging. I'd rather tell them in here, fine. As far as I can tell, this book is what it claims to be. I am a very unlikely person to be associated with something like this because I'm a natural-born skeptic. I'm not a natural believer. And for a long time, I thought, how can I express an opinion about this book which is totally defensible? And here is the way I elect to word this opinion. If this book
is not what it claims to be, I can't prove it. And I've had an excellent opportunity to investigate it for more than 20 years. One of the first things that I checked into many years ago was, where is the gold-plated Cadillac?